From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block at NPR West in California.
And I'm Michelle Norris in Washington, D.C. First, it was the Obama administration's pay czar, and now the Federal Reserve has joined the assault on executive compensation. Today, the pay czar, Kenneth Feinberg, announced restrictions for top executives at seven companies that have gotten the most government aid during the financial crisis. And the Fed announced guidelines that would affect a lot more banks. We'll talk with Feinberg in just a moment. First, NPR's John Yatsky has an overview of the day's events.
Feinberg's restrictions on executive pay apply only to 175 top-earning executives at seven firms who together have received hundreds of billions of dollars in government aid. Some, like AIG, GM, and Chrysler, are essentially wards of the government. Others, like Citigroup and Bank of America, are struggling. Feinberg said he examined the pay plans initially submitted by the seven firms and found them excessive. He began a protracted period of negotiation that led to today's binding order. The headline numbers include an average 90% reduction in cash compensation for executives, though much of that could be replaced by compensation in stock. Feinberg also placed a cap of $500,000 on cash salaries for most of the 175 employees, and he requires that bonuses be paid in stock and based on performance. Stock would have to be held for several years to focus employees on long-term profitability. Speaking at a separate White House event, President Obama said Feinberg had done a good job.
I believe he's taken an important step forward today in curbing the influence of executive compensation on Wall Street while still allowing these companies to succeed and prosper.
However, Feinberg's direct effect on 2009 pay at the seven companies is limited to November and December. He said he will not take back pay that employees earned in the first 10 months of the year. His restrictions may have a larger effect next year because they become the baseline for negotiating 2010 compensation at the seven companies. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve today released its guidelines for pay. They're aimed at limiting excessive risk-taking at the thousands of banks the Fed regulates, right down to the level of loan officer. Chief lobbyist Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable says the industry is on board.
The Fed's approach is balanced and measured, and they focus on reducing excessive risk, but they don't go so far as setting pay caps.
Bank analyst Nancy Bush of NAB Research says she thinks today's dual announcements by the Fed and Treasury are aimed at showing some government action ahead of the year-end bonus season on Wall Street. Bush says Goldman Sachs, for instance, has signaled it will pay out somewhere around $20 billion in bonuses.
I think they're trying to dampen populist anger before those numbers become known. I am very doubtful about whether this is going to be enough to do that.
Pay czar Feinberg said he hoped his guidelines would become a model for Wall Street firms. Nancy Bush was doubtful they would have a significant effect. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
A microbrewer in Vermont recently found himself in a copyright dispute. It was a dispute with a big beverage company. The microbrewer's Vermonster beer sounded too similar to Hansen Beverages' Monster energy drink. But Hansen, the big company, may not have anticipated the cyber support campaign waged by Vermonster's loyal fans. From Vermont Public Radio, Charlotte Albright reports.
It's late afternoon, tasting time at the nondescript Rock Art Brewery. In his office next to the bar, founder Matt Nadeau recalls how this mess began last month with a threatening letter from Hansen Beverages. Hansen accused him of unfairly embedding its trademark name, Monster, in his new high-alcohol brand, Vermonster Beer.
What do you mean cease and desist? I'm not doing anything wrong. So certainly at first I was scared. You know, what do you do?
Nadeau's lawyer assured him he was in the right, but warned that a costly court battle could drive his business into the ground. Then Nadeau's wife sent an email message to friends and customers. A college student started an anti-Monster Facebook page. The internet went wild. Some stores began to boycott Monster. Yesterday, the combatants declared a truce. Rodney Stacks, CEO of Hansen Beverage, claims Monster never intended to drive Vermonster out of the market. However, he did get the brewer to promise to stay out of the energy drink business. For NPR News, I'm Charlotte Albright in northern Vermont.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. President Obama will soon have to make some critical decisions about the future of NASA. Next year, the agency is planning to retire its fleet of space shuttles. Meanwhile, NASA is working on new rockets and capsules that could take astronauts back to the moon. But is the moon the right destination?
Well, today, an independent panel convened by the White House released its report on the future of human spaceflight. The panel's chair, Norm Augustine, pronounced this major finding.
The human spaceflight program that the United States is currently pursuing is one that is on an unsustainable trajectory.
NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce is here to tell us more about this. First of all, remind us why this administration, the Obama administration, wants to review NASA's plans in the first place.
Well, 5 years ago, President Bush laid out a plan for going back to the moon and on to Mars, and NASA's been working towards that. But a lot of questions have been raised about the progress that's been made and where things stand. Once the space shuttles get retired, there's going to be a gap of 5 years or more before new NASA rockets would be ready. And during that time, American astronauts could only get into space on Russian rockets. And there's been criticism of the whole plan to go back to the moon. Some people say we'll just get bogged down there and not really do anything new. There's been criticism of the new NASA rockets under development. Some people have said other designs would be less costly and make more sense. And then there's the space station. I mean, the current plans don't provide funding for the space station past 2015. And some people have said it makes no sense to spend two decades planning and building this thing and then just abandoning it.
So some outside experts looked at all this. What did the panel recommend?
Well, they said it might be wise to provide funding for the space shuttle for one more year and also extend the life of the space station until 2020. And as far as different rocket designs, they basically laid out the pros and cons of a variety of approaches. They said it might be time for private companies to take over transporting crew and cargo to low Earth orbit so that NASA can focus more on ambitious exploration efforts. But
yeah.
Their main conclusion was that NASA just needs more money. I mean, they said that no matter what the plan is, if NASA's going to do anything exciting and meaningful in terms of human space exploration, they're going to need about another $3 billion a year.
Well, speaking of human space exploration, what about the idea of returning astronauts to the moon? Was that endorsed in this report?
Well, they said you can go to the moon. I mean, that's one option. But they also came up with a different program that they call the Flexible Path. And the idea here is that you would send people out to different points in the solar system, like maybe near-Earth asteroids, or maybe you would orbit the moon to Mars. And you could visit the moon on this plan, but it wouldn't be the central focus. The focus would be more on getting people further and further out into the solar system with the eventual goal of getting to Mars.
When President Bush talked about going to Mars, there was a very interesting reaction at that point. Why not just aim for Mars directly?
Well, the panel did look at that, and they said that Mars is the ultimate goal, but going there directly would just be too difficult and expensive.
And now that the White House finally has this report, what happens next?
Well, I mean, the president has a lot of other things on his plate right now, but the administrator of NASA, Charles Bolden, recently told one newspaper that he hopes to meet with the president by the end of the year.
And what about Congress?
Well, Congress had hearings on this committee's work last month, and they basically said, you know, they've endorsed NASA's current plan, and so maybe the problem isn't the plan, maybe it's just the funding.
And that's certainly going to be a big issue in these times right now on Capitol Hill. Nell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce.
For decades, the federal student loan program has paid private lenders and banks a subsidy for loans they make to college students. The Obama administration wants to bypass banks. It would have the federal government lend directly to students. Some schools have already switched to direct lending, and NPR's Claudio Sanchez explains why.
$8 billion worth of student loans dried up in the last 10 months of 2008 as some of the nation's biggest banks and state guarantors of student loans either scaled down or stopped making loans altogether. Across the country, students and their parents didn't know what was going on.
At the rate many lenders were leaving the program, how certain could that parent be that that lender might be there for them that year, but what would happen the following year?
Nobody knew, says Anna Griswold, director of financial aid at Penn State University. But at the time, she says, 40,000 students were in danger of losing access to federal loans. Eventually, other lenders stepped in, and most students got their money. But by then, says Griswold,
it was very clear and a no-brainer as to what made the most sense for us here at Penn State.
What Penn State did was switch from the Federal Family Education Loan Program, which depends heavily on private lenders, to the direct lending program run by the U.S. Department of Education. Penn State was not alone. In the last year, over 500 colleges have made that switch. For good reason, says Robert Shireman, Deputy Undersecretary of Education.
We can be sure that the families, the students who need loans, will have them available when they need the funds. And we won't have a last-minute problem of a lender pulling out because of something that's maybe happened in the stock market or in credit markets.
Reliability, says Anna Griswold, is the biggest difference now that Penn State is a direct lending institution. The switch, she says, was simple. For students, little has changed. The financial aid office certifies a student's eligibility for federal aid online, processes the application, and sends it to the U.S. Department of Education via a secure system online. But opponents of direct lending say the Penn State example does not address a bigger issue.
To me, it boils down to competition and choice.
John Dean is special counsel to the Consumer Bankers Association. He says about 2,000 private lenders and banks today participate in the federal student loan program. Replacing them with a single lender, the federal government, would destroy competition and choice. Besides, says Dean, colleges have had the option to switch to direct lending since 1994. So why have 8 out of 10 schools chosen not to?
They obviously think that the customer service is going to be better.
The Education Department's Robert Shireman disagrees. He says this is all about creating a more efficient, cheaper way of lending money to students.
We can't afford to spend the money for an institution to choose something that costs taxpayers more.
Shireman says once private lenders are out of the picture, the $8 to $10 billion in subsidies the government has been paying them will go back into federal aid for students. The House of Representatives has already voted in favor of direct lending. It'll soon come up for a vote in the Senate, where passage is less certain. But the administration is so confident it will pass, the Education Department has drawn up plans to issue all loans through the direct lending program beginning next summer. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
Now, Tanya Turek. She's a children's book blogger and mother of three, and she has a more exacting view of Jeff Kenney's character, Greg Heffley.
Oh, if he was my son, I don't know what I'd do. He's just lazy and self-interested and doesn't think about anybody else. He's not empathetic in the least. And, you know, I think really he's like a condensed hyper version of what kids are like at this age, because I think the reason adults laugh at it is because we all remember doing something horrible to one of our friends as a kid, or lying to an adult or something like that. But, you know, we maybe did it once or twice, whereas in these books, Greg is doing it almost every day.
Well, you note that the book is not just fantastical. I mean, like, a lot of the scenes really do spring from real life, like
yes.
the cheese touch, which a lot of the kids yeah. wrote in about, which really is about, you know, kids being ostracized for really
yeah.
strange reasons.
True. And, you know, I really admire how Kenney captures that so astutely. You know, I think what I would like to see, you know, Kenney makes a point of saying that his books are lesson-free and that they're all about the humor. And I think that's great. I don't think kids' literature has to have morally upstanding characters in it. They can be ambiguous. But I think for younger readers, maybe the parents can be the moral voice outside of the text. You know, they can do a reality check with their kids after they read the book and say, hey, you know, what'd you think about the cheese touch and how Greg treated Rowley, you know, or something like that.
So why are parents so suspicious of these books? Why are they worried?
Wow, I didn't realize they were. I kind of thought it was just me. But
you know, maybe you could help us understand the tension, because on one hand, librarians have really come to appreciate these books, some reluctantly because they work so well with reluctant readers.
Yes.
And parents, if you look at the blogosphere, a lot of parents are really ambivalent about this. They think the books are snarky. They think they're subversive. They think that they introduce kids to life lessons that they probably don't need in the pages of a book. I know when I read these books with my kids, I find myself laughing really hard and then pulling back and saying, ooh, do I want my kids to be laughing at that? Is that a good thing?
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth about this because I feel like on a certain level, the humor in the book is really adult and it is akin to, you know, maybe the humor on The Office or Curb Your Enthusiasm where someone's being a horrible person and everybody else is in on the joke and you wonder if the kids reading the book are in on the joke. But I just, above all else, I think this is a really great opportunity for parents to talk to their kids about what they're reading and figure it out that way. I don't think there's any reason to take a book out of a kid's hand if you as the parent are going to be involved and be the moral voice outside of the text.
Tanya Turek, it's been good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Oh, it's been an honor. Thanks, Michelle.
Tanya Turek blogs about children's books at booksforyourkids.com, and four there is numeral four. She also works in the children's department at a Barnes & Noble bookstore in San Diego, California. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block in California.
And I'm Michelle Norris in Washington. First up this hour, we have a story that begins with some old-time potions promised cures for just about any ailment. And it ends with our modern-day healthcare system. It is a story of how we wound up with a system where employers pay for health insurance.
So how did we get here? After all, employers don't pay for our groceries or our gas. NPR's Planet Money has been exploring this question, and as Adam Davidson and Alex Bloomberg discovered, there was never any central logic at work, just a bunch of accidents that brought us to where we are today.
To learn about how we got our modern healthcare system, you do have to study history, but you don't have to study too much of it. You can ignore most of what was going on before, say, the 1920s.
That's right, Adam. We dug up some archival healthcare radio stories. Here's a bit.
You know that unless some relief comes to you, that you're going to be in the undertaker's parlor on the old cold slab being embalmed for a funeral. Well, why do you hold back? Why do you twist?
The audio quality isn't great, so let me explain. This is Dr. John Brinkley, and he was huge in the U.S. in the 1920s, dispensing on-air health advice through his radio shows. Whatever problem folks had, he had one fabulous solution: transplant a goat gland into your body. It was perfect for everything from dementia to impotence to flatulence.
And if, somehow, a goat gland didn't cure your ills, you could always use Bonor's electromagnetic bathing fluid, Clark Stanley's snake oil liniment.
Oh, and my personal favorite, mugwump, for the cure and prevention of all venereal disease.
We're having fun here, of course, but the point is that up until, say, 1910, 1920, most medical care in the U.S. was basically medieval, a bunch of potions that did nothing.
Luckily, they were cheap potions. Healthcare was a trivial part of the average person's annual budget. In 1900, the average American spent $5 a year on healthcare. That was cheap even then, $100 in today's dollars.
So it was a trade-off. On the one hand, healthcare was cheap. That's a big plus over the system we have today. On the other hand, it didn't actually make you any better.
Right. And of course, nobody had health insurance. Why would you get health insurance for something that doesn't work and only costs $5 a year?
So, the first step in getting us to our current healthcare system, medicine got better. Doctors started curing the sick.
There were new and, for the first time, effective medicines starting in the 1910s and 20s, especially antibiotics. There was also a medical school revolution.
All this transformed healthcare, which was especially clear in hospitals. Before, say, 1911, hospitals were not anything like what we think of today. They were really poorhouses where the indigent went to die.
Melissa Thomason is an economic historian at Miami University in Ohio.
Hospitals have a radical transformation in the early part of the 20th century. Hospitals are actually marketing themselves as places to have babies, do appendectomies, take your tonsils out. They're focusing on generally things with happy outcomes.
Turns out effective healthcare is a lot more expensive than quack elixirs. All these clean hospitals, educated doctors, real pharmacological research, it costs money.
People were willing to pay when they were really sick, but it wasn't yet common to just go to the doctor for checkups or for a survivable illness.
By the late 1920s, hospitals noticed most of their beds were going empty every night. They wanted to get people who weren't deathly ill to start coming in.
An official at Baylor University Hospital in Dallas, Texas, noticed that Americans, on average, were spending more on cosmetics than on medical care. He said, "We spend a dollar or so at a time for cosmetics and do not notice the high cost. The ribbon counter clerk can pay 50 cents, 75 cents, or a dollar a month, yet it would take about 20 years to set aside a large hospital bill."
So Baylor Hospital wanted to figure out how to get ribbon counter clerks and anyone else they could find in Dallas to pay for health care like they pay for lipstick, a tiny bit every month.
Baylor started small. They offered a deal to a group of public school teachers in Dallas. They told them, "You pay us 50 cents a month and we'll cover your hospital visits."
And then the Depression hit. Almost every hospital in the country saw their patient load disappear, so the Baylor idea became hugely popular and eventually got a name, Blue Cross. Again, Melissa Thomason.
You know, when I actually started studying this stuff, I got interested in it because I wondered why we have an employment-based health insurance plan. It doesn't seem very logical, but it comes right out of Blue Cross selling insurance to groups of people who probably wouldn't need it, that is, people who were healthy enough to work. The genius in marketing this by Blue Cross is marketing it to groups of workers.
Blue Cross eventually shows up in almost every state, but it's still pretty small. Not that many people have it. To get to our modern insurance system, you need another step. Go to war.
War has always had two fronts. The fighting front with its fury of battle, and behind the lines, the civilian front with its job of living and producing.
The war economy is an entirely different ballgame.
Economic historian Melissa Thomason says that if the Great Depression inadvertently inspired employer-based health insurance, World War II accidentally spread the idea everywhere.
Essentially, we go from being a mixed economy with mostly market and some government intervention to being a planned economy. I mean, think of government rationing on all levels.
Good afternoon. Here's a reminder from the Office of Price Administration. All old type B and C gas coupons expire midnight August 31st. That's Tuesday night.
What they tell people is you legally cannot raise prices, you can't raise wages. And so you can't find workers who can work for you. You can't lure them by increasing wages. You know, so what's a poor employer to do? They turn to fringe benefits. And they just started offering more and more generous health insurance plans.
Then another big change, the one that really cemented the system and got us where we are today. It came entirely by accident in 1943.
The Internal Revenue Service ruled that employer-based health care should be tax-free. Then, in 1954, a new law made the tax advantage of employer-based health care even more attractive.
And if you don't think a tax law change can have a huge impact on health care, Melissa Thomason has some data for you, pal. Just look at how the number of people with employer-based health insurance changed over time.
You start from 9% of the population in 1940 to 63% of the population in 1953.
Wow.
I mean, everybody starts getting in on it. It just grows like gangbusters. And by the 1960s, you know, roughly 70% of the population is covered by some kind of private, what the AMA would say, voluntary health insurance plan.
By the mid-1960s, Thomason says, Americans started to see our system, where people with good jobs get health care through work and people without good jobs have to look to the government as if it were the natural order of things.
To Thomason and other economic historians, though, there's nothing natural or inevitable about it. It's simply the result of a series of historical accidents. I'm Alex Blumberg.
And I'm Adam Davidson, NPR News.